Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, as usual. And Jim, we start with the good. Each week, the president and then a member of the opposition party give a weekly address. It used to be always be on radio in the last few years, I think pretty much since Obama took over. He's done his on YouTube, and the Republicans have kind of followed suit, and so it's not really the weekly radio address anymore, and nobody really pays that much attention to it. But heading into Christmas, the final Republican address came from Pennsylvania Congressman Mike Kelly, represents a district in western Pennsylvania, which is coal country, and he decided to give the president a local artifact as his Christmas present this year, but it's not as insulting as you think. Here's what he had to say.
I'm offering the president a lump of coal because this product right here holds the potential for a 21st century economic revival. You see, coal is our most abundant and valuable resource. It lights our homes. It keeps our electric bills low, and it puts food on the table for countless families. No other nation in the world has been blessed with such abundant, affordable, and accessible resources. And with all that God has given us, we shouldn't be just trying to keep up with the pack. My goodness, we should be leading the world. Now, if only we had a president willing to seize this opportunity. Now, he tells us he's for all the above, but then he leaves out everything that's below.
Pretty good line there, Jim. This is a good issue for the Republicans to push heading into the new year. They've already said Keystone will be their number one issue. Obama made it pretty clear on Friday he's going to veto that. But this is a winning issue for conservatives, and it's the right thing to do. And that's smart politics on the part of the GOP.
It is. And I want to give a tip of the hat to Kelly, because that's a cute way of tying it into the holiday season and kind of making the point in a memorable way. On Friday, when Obama held his final press conference of the year, he made pretty clear that he was not really interested in signing the Keystone Pipeline. And look, it's been 6 years. It's not like, you know, at this point, the, well, we need to study it more excuse is a way of saying no and trying to avoid the political hit of saying no. This has always polled very well. There's now lots of indications that this is, that Obama's going to veto it. So to me, I would say, you know, Republicans, pass that bill as fast as possible. Put it on his desk. Let him veto it. You probably won't have the votes to overcome the veto, but that's fine. Look, this is a popular idea that Americans support, even with gas prices going down. And he, you know, Obama deserves to pay the political price for opposing this. By the way, I'm always struck on Friday's press conference. Greg, did you notice how Obama likes to say really obvious things and then act like they're profound?
Sure.
Like, what if we know the Keystone Pipeline is not about American oil. It is about Canadian oil. And then he kind of raises his eyebrows like, see what I did there? See? Huh? I just pointed something out that nobody else has noticed. No, Mr. President. Obama was at his too cute for words self, and we shouldn't be the least bit surprised to see him falling in with his environmentalist movement panels on this. And look, you know, if he wants to take that stand, fine. It's going to cost him in the polls. It's going to give Republicans a lot to, you know, that's going to be a painful veto for him. But you want to make that decision, Mr. President, you go right ahead.
Again, that's a good issue for the GOP. Let's see if they follow suit on coal issues as well. Going after the EPA regulations, I think, is a big, big deal in addition to the Keystone vote. So hopefully that's not the only issue that they pursue on the energy front coming up here in 2015. All right, on to the bad martini. I'm guessing most of you knew what it would be, and it's a pretty obvious one. It's the murder, execution style, of two New York Police Department officers on Saturday by a guy who woke up in the morning committed to kill people. He tried to kill his girlfriend in Baltimore, hijacked her Instagram account, and basically said he's on his way to kill pigs, in his words. Then he got to Brooklyn shortly before 3 o'clock. He found two officers sitting in their patrol car, shot them before most likely they even knew what was happening. At that point, a lot of chaos breaking out in New York City. This is, of course, in the wake of all the protests following the grand jury decisions on Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City. And following those grand jury decisions, there were some protests that were deemed by the media as nonviolent or peaceful, but some of the chanting going on in these protests, that you've heard, I'm sure, about again over the weekend here. What do we want dead cops? When do we want them now? Well, that's what happened. So there's a lot of anger towards not only folks like Al Sharpton, but also New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who definitely took the side of the protesters prior to these murders on Saturday. When he came into the press conference, a group of officers turned their back on him. And Pat Lynch, the head of the New York Police Department Union, had this to say on Sunday.
There's blood on many hands tonight. Those that incited violence on the street under the guise of protest that tried to tear down what New York City police officers did every day. We tried to warn. It must not go on. It cannot be tolerated. That blood on the hands starts on the steps of City Hall in the office of the mayor.
So there you have it from the cops. Jim, the killed officers were Wen Jianlu and Rafael Ramos. And now, of course, there's this huge debate that is playing out about who's responsible. The left, of course, saying obviously it's the killer, which everyone agrees with on a certain level. But then the question is how much the statements, repeated statements of political leaders like de Blasio played into this, and whether he can ever regain the trust of the New York City Police Department.
Yeah, just two little vivid anecdotes that illuminate just how bad things have gotten in New York City so fast. At Wood Hill Hospital in Brooklyn, where de Blasio was going to, where the officers had been taken, de Blasio apparently is trying to speak to officers and says, "We're all in this together." And an unnamed police officer responded, "No, we're not," which I think kind of indicates this. And you've seen Commissioner Bratton indicating that he thinks that the police department does not have faith in the mayor. And I think that that line of communication has been cut. And I believe it was Ray Kelly, the former commissioner, who was saying he thinks there needs to be some sort of intermediary interacting with the mayor. Meaning that I grew up not too far from New York City during the Koch and Dinkins years. And things were pretty bad during the Dinkins years, particularly Crown Heights riots and things like that. But I don't think I've ever seen a mayor and a police department at odds this intensely and this severely. And I just don't see any way that that trust gets rebuilt anytime soon. I think it indicates that there is a real price to be paid for palling around with Al Sharpton and for kind of demagoguing a bit with these tragic events like this and kind of acting like, well, I can get some votes out of this. I can get some popularity out of this. Two other kind of really just kind of horrifying indicators of where things are in New York City. And let's face it, probably well beyond that. After the officers' killings, a union-generated message to the 35,000-officer NYPD warned officers to respond to every radio call with two cars, quote, no matter what the opinion of the patrol supervisor. It also says, do not make arrests unless absolutely necessary. The president of the detectives union told members in a letter to work in threes when out on the street, wear bulletproof vests, and keep aware of their surroundings. Cops in New York really feel like they are targets in a war right now. And unfortunately, we don't know whether this is, you know, the last of these incidents or whether there'll be more of these incidents. And I think, you know, we've had a very interesting discussion towards the end of last week about the interview, the movie about making fun of North Korea and the studio's decision to pull it, whether that is akin to shouting fire in a crowded theater, as the brilliant Touré declared on MSNBC. A lot of conservatives feel like they were really unfairly criticized and blamed for the Gifford shooting out in Arizona. And a lot of people are very kind of eager to turn around and play fair, you know, turnabout is fair play. If we got blamed for crimes that we had nothing to do with, we're going to blame you for this one. I don't think it's necessarily fair to blame de Blasio for this police shooting. I don't think if he'd said his words any differently, I'm not sure it would have changed the actions of this man. I'm not so sure if any of the protests against police have changed this man. I will say, chanting, what do we want, dead cops, when do we want it now? If you do that, you can't be that surprised that somebody decides to take that seriously. And I think that there are a lot of, you know, we should have a very broad definition of the First Amendment. But I think calling for cops to be killed, that's a threat. And that is something that I think is, if this movement wanted to delegitimize itself in the eyes of most people, I think that chant does it. And I think they have to, you know, look very seriously at themselves and ask, have they created a circumstance in which people feel the right thing to do is murder police officers? And if so, this stops being a protest movement and it starts being a criminal organization.
On to the crazy martini now, and you alluded to the story like we talked about all last week, and that's Sony's decision to not release the interview on Christmas Day as originally planned in response to the demands of the hackers threatening 9/11 style attacks on theaters and so forth. So the issue came up at President Obama's year-end press conference, which for a guy whose party got pounded, Jim, it's amazing what a great year we had as a country and how his policies have all done well for the American people. But one of the questions that he was asked was about whether Sony did the right thing. And the president said this.
I wish they had spoken to me first. I would have told them, do not get into a pattern in which you're intimidated by these kinds of criminal attacks.
If only they had reached out to the president. Well, it turns out they did. Sony CEO Michael Linton says he's disappointed in what Obama had to say, pointing out that Sony did reach out to the White House. We definitely spoke to a senior advisor in the White House to talk about the situation. The fact is, did we talk to the president himself? Well, the White House was certainly aware of the situation. So, Jim, just when you think, well, why in the world would he not tell the truth about this? We get this bizarre story.
Because, you know, the entire MO of this White House is to get through the news cycle, you know, and hope that no one goes back and checks what he says. This is why he keeps using statistics that are out of date, whether it's on women's pay or incidences of rape on college campuses or, you know, shovel-ready jobs and things like that. A couple of things jump out. One, his whole thing of, like, this is a very perfect little pause in the sense that he gets to say, well, I would have taken a bold stand. You know, I would have not let anyone be intimidated by North Korea. But they didn't call me. Theoretically, he could say, you know what, I'm calling on Sony to release this picture, and the U.S. federal government will do whatever it takes to ensure the safety of moviegoers and to ensure the cybersecurity of Sony Pictures from here on out. We will not be intimidated. You can't attack our citizens that way. He could have said that. He could have, you know, he could have taken action, but he'd much rather not take action and instead do something in the vein of, well, if only they'd called me, I could have done something then, but now I can't do anything. So just remember, I would have been tough, but I didn't have a chance, so there's nothing that can be done now. As if this is the last time North Korea is ever going to, or anybody else is ever going to revert to cyber warfare in order to get their way. And a lot of people have pointed out, and I think it's a very good chance, in fact, Variety of all sources is saying, look, there's an argument that U.S. cybersecurity is really, really not up to par. I'm not enough of an expert on that subject to know whether that's the case. I think it's pretty obvious that Sony is. And I think that, you know, there is probably some sort of national role. Like, we don't, you know, we can't personally defend ourselves from ISIS or from Al-Qaeda. So we need the government to do that. I don't know if the federal government can say, look, hey, Sony, you got lousy cybersecurity. It's on you. Not our fault. What do you expect us to do about it? And also, Sony certainly doesn't have any retaliatory tools at its disposal, whereas the U.S. government does. Now, it's conceivable that we've got something in the works and Obama just didn't want to talk about it. But his answer sure was kind of indicating, well, it's all Sony's fault. And if only they talked to me, everything would have been fine.
Jim, that's a good point. However, given the web track record of this administration, I'm pretty sure I'd prefer to leave it to the private sector.
I was going to say cyberdefenses.gov. the site went down, but Sibelius says it'll get up any second now.
Jim, have a good day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to join us on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.